This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much by going to airbnb.co.uk/host. Yeah. So we're going to be talking about civil war today. Mm. And in setting up just now for this show, James just took a call and I had 5 minutes to kill. We're all set up. I'd already gone through my notes. And I thought, you know what? I know nothing about the actual American Civil War.
Yeah.
Obviously, we never learn it. It's not in any curriculum I ever studied at school. It's just a complete... Because it's a national specific thing to...
Divorce, beheaded, died, divorce, beheaded, survived.
And we also had our own Civil War as well.
We did.
Yeah. So I know the names. I know the Gettysburg Address, and I know Lincoln.
Yeah,
slavery, Ulysses S. Grant,
all that,
and that's about it. And anyway, so
watch National Treasure.
Yeah. I just did
Declaration of Independence. Yeah.
No, that's the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah,
for the War of Independence.
Yeah, I know. I'm just...
Well, straight away, James, that's incorrect.
American history.
And also not to be confused with the War of 1812, where the British burnt down the White House. Did you know that?
Heard of it.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah.
Not terrible. There's horrible things happen.
I know.
We're like, yeah, I guess.
Oh, history? It's just blood.
Did you know
death.
They rebooted the Omen prequel?
Yeah. So. Let's do the podcast.
Yeah.
Yes, so we did a little deep dive just there. Did a 10-minute Wikipedia session on the American Civil War.
Such a history, Dad.
Very interesting.
Yeah,
history is interesting. History is amazing.
It is interesting. It is amazing. It's just funny. I do love it. With age.
Oh, yeah.
You'll get worse or better or whatever you want to call it.
Depending on how you feel about it. I'll get deeper into it. Oh, yeah. Anything to do with how they did that in that time. And that's
it's brilliant.
The older history gets, the less interested I am. I'm more of a 20th century mad, really.
Of course. I mean,
I'll stretch to the 19th, yeah. But do you still do that thing where someone says, oh, it was in the 16th century, and your brain has to go, so that's not the 1500s?
Yeah, every time.
Yeah. You were going to say?
When?
At the beginning of the show?
Oh, yeah. I like to be overall...
Changing subject now.
Changing subject, not America. Overall, I like to be fairly positive about the state of cinema and, like, is it dying?
Oh, goodness.
And I think, we talk about this every single week of, like, oh, well, this film, blah, blah, blah. Oh, you know, it's changing. Yeah. Big screen, small screen, boutique. Yeah. Where do the films come out? There's only a few instances where I look at a film and go, it's dead, isn't it? And that's when I see the trailer concept title for Godzilla X Kong.
Oh, yeah.
And I go, oh God, yeah, it's really dead, isn't it? No disrespect to that film. And if it is good and people have enjoyed it,
because
it's made a load of money, I'm almost just like, God, this is it, isn't it?
Bottom of the barrel, just smash two IPs together.
There's the great thing, which was, you know, the guys that do the fake board meetings. And he's like, okay, we got a Godzilla Kong thing. Yeah. And he's like, what if we put Transformers in it? And he's like, you're fired, but write that down. That's a great idea. It's like, right, we did Godzilla V Kong. We've done Godzilla X Kong. What is going to be the next letter? Godzilla Y Kong? What do you mean Y Kong? That's so funny. I don't know who the guys that do this.
I read one review that... This guy had taken it too literally, the X. He was like, so it's, you know, they've used X like Godzilla multiplied Kong. And I'm like, no.
It's a brand collab.
It means collaboration.
Yeah.
It means...
Because they don't actually take down the greater evil.
It's just Godzilla Kong. You don't actually verbalize the X. You just say Godzilla Kong. Yeah. But it's interesting. This guy was like, they don't so much as multiply in this film as like crash together. And I'm like, you're reading it too literally.
You've thought about this more than anyone making it ever did.
You've never worked on a brand brief, have you?
Yeah. Yeah. And also with those films, again, I've seen one of them secondhand on a plane through someone else.
You never saw the original 2014?
I've seen 2014, but I feel like...
Also, that was like before they decided to make it into a whole thing, wasn't it?
I feel like that the only thing that shares with these ones is the design of Godzilla.
Yes, it's
other
so
than
true.
That, it just feels like... But I feel like the entire world and all of its cities get destroyed in every one of these films. How much more humanity is left? And they don't seem to be bothered by it. Again, I've not seen these films. Yes. But they don't seem to be bothered that Rio just gets uplifted.
I guess Rio must be sacrificed. I mean, Rio is a huge city to wipe out as well. Like one of the most populous cities on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, Rio gets sacrificed to save the world from, you know, at least the rest of the world's intact, right?
But then they get the next film, they're destroying cities all over.
Like, yeah, but let them fight. That's what he says, isn't it, in the 2014 one.
The bigger monkey and lizard.
I was a bit disappointed by 2014's Godzilla.
Me too.
I thought he looked cool, halo jump cool, all that
stylistically
stuff.
Tasteful.
But it's pretty dour, pretty humorless.
They killed Heisenberg off in the beginning, which I thought was a mistake.
I knew that was coming. Everyone was surprised, but I was like, it goes, you've got all those cast members, then it goes, and Bryan Cranston.
He's there but he's in half the trailer. He's
going to send us back to the Stone Age.
That's what he used to say.
And then it's Aaron Taylor-Johnson's movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's in it.
He might not be Bond.
I don't, yeah.
It's a real thing. That all came out. He's been offered the role of Bond. That was the story, wasn't it?
Yeah. I wonder.
And it just went.
I still, you and I are of slightly different opinions. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you think that it's been slightly mishandled and that, like, you know, what's happened that they wanted to do it. But I think it's all part of a, very cynically, it's all planned. It's all planned. I'm not saying he's going to become Bond.
Mm.
I don't know either way. It's all part of the media circus to build up the hype, I believe.
Because it was just zero to 100 miles an hour with that story, wasn't it?
Be like this.
Because
I
know that traditionally the Broccolis, the people in control of the Bond franchise, like to announce it themselves. They like to have the actor be announced. It's a whole thing. They get Daniel Craig on a boat in a suit, wearing a life jacket.
Yeah.
And this is Bond. Loads of photographers. Mm. Next 10 years, this is your Bond now.
Mm.
But I like Aaron Taylor-Johnson. I think he'd be good. He's a good amount of fame, I think, to take on that role, but not too much.
I really also only have such... I have a limited interest in Bond, really.
Yeah.
Film to film. Yeah. You know, I take it...
You're there for it when it's there, but it doesn't occupy your mind.
I almost would go to see it more because we do the show than out of pure interest, really.
I guess like the sort of aging dad of me is that every so often maybe... And if you're thinking like Roman Empire vibes, once a month Bond slips into my mind, and I'm like,
I'm going to be a history dad, and you're going to be a James Bond dad.
Yeah.
You're going to be
so
like, you're going to have collecting the little
framed posters.
Did you know actually in Octopussy that they did this thing, but in the Craig movies and this?
I once worked at a charity event that was it was James Bond themed, and all of the auction items were famous relics and pieces and experiences relating to do with James Bond. They had this huge table, so like they had the new Safin masks from the latest film. And then they just had like old signed records from these actors and thing, dates with Bollinger, 007 sponsor. It was quite fun to see all these little trinkets and bits, Aston Martin stuff. It's cool.
Did you bump into something and knock it off its thing?
Yeah, like a glass egg.
Yeah. Who did this?
No, we never got there.
The assailant.
One of the coolest days I've ever had for work was going to the Aston Martin factory.
Oh, wow.
And they remade 10 of the original Goldfinger Aston Martin DB5s. Don't quote me on that. And I got to sit in this car, which had the button and the guns that came out the thing. I was driven, but I was filming in the passenger seat in that car for like 2 hours,
really,
and I just got to film the handle and see. And I don't care
big
about
kid,
cars.
Weren't you?
It was amazing, the most beautiful car ever.
You know, I don't care about cars either. Sometimes guys will try and talk to me about cars, and I'm like, whoa, let me stop you right there. I know nothing. I don't even think about what car. I can drive, but I don't own a car.
No. I don't have a romantic relationship with cars at all. I like the idea of a Tesla because I like tech, and for me that's like a gadget that drives.
So if I
was to make loads of money, a car's the last thing I'd spend money on, but it would probably be a techie car. I get Cybertruck.
But it could be the most expensive car in the world.
But it's definitely the last thing I'd spend money on.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I'd be buying a nicer coat before I got a car. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, I see your future. Just you see that in a fur coat,
no car.
Yeah.
Or just in like a horrible little, like the in-betweeners car. Or, I look like Snoop Dogg in like a fur coat, but I'm squeezing into.
You know that yellow and red car you pay money to go into as a kid? That's on the side of like every, or like you know the play. Yeah, that's the big version.
Me coming out of the club with a cane when Pop Kitchen really takes off in a couple of years. You know, I drive up to my yacht, but just like pedaling like a Flintstone.
Welcome to episode 123 of Pop Kitchen. Look at that for a number. Pretty unique.
One, two, three, four, five.
Yes, yeah. Lou Bega. Yeah. And welcome. I'm a little bit groggy today.
Yeah, yeah,
so James is going to have to steer me a little. I'm a little bit all over the place. Yeah. But welcome. We're going to be talking about Civil War, Alex Garland's new movie.
Not the Marvel film.
No, just Civil War. Posters everywhere.
Yeah.
The tube, the bus, Civil War. Yeah. Very Apocalypse Now inflected posters.
Side note, I think of all the Marvel films I'm happy to just stick on, I think Civil War's a really good shout. It's really fun. You've got loads of characters in there. Good action. Good film. Good fights. It matters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, I remember that moment. That was like fun before it all came
together.
I really liked it.
I don't know. I've never rewatched it. I found Black Panther quite boring as a character in that. I found the whole
He's not in it that much.
Yeah, he's not in it that much. You're absolutely right. He's not in it that much. And I found just the whole Captain America sort of like, hey, no, I've got to stand up for what's right. I'm just like, someone should have died in that movie.
I've said this many times. Rhodey should have died. There should have been consequences to the heroes fighting each other. And he fell. And I was like, oh, great. Imagine how pissed off Tony Stark would be if all that killed Rhodey.
Yeah.
And then he just lost the use of his legs and then just got some super legs.
Nanotech.
And it's not like he had a huge role to play in Avengers where he was needed.
No, he just wears a big suit.
Consequences, anyway.
So we're going to be doing Civil War. we're also going to be reviewing Ripley, the new Netflix TV series.
The Talented Mr. Fame.
Yeah, the Talented Mr. Fame. Well, yeah. Actually, there's
Not the Ripley alien
prequel.
But I'm sure it's coming, by the way.
I'm actually
surprised we've not got a Ripley spin-off prequel series, whatever.
I guess it's so Sigourney. Like, who are you gonna? Like,
yeah.
They do it. What am I talking about? Of course, they find a way. So we're gonna be talking about that. Great new series. James and I watched. James watched all of it. Watched a bit of it.
Yeah.
And then our bonus this week. Of course, guys, you can always rely on us to have more content than you can deal with.
Yeah.
We got a bonus coming out this week where James is gonna be talking about
The First Omen.
Remember The Omen from the 70s and the reboot remake in the early noughties. They brought out
a shot remake, basically.
The First Omen. Now
this is the first Omen. This is the prequel.
With Bill Nye.
Bill Nye, Charles Dance.
Is Francis McDormand in it?
No. Ralph Ineson's in there.
Oh, yeah.
Ralph Ineson's got a wonderfully scratchy, deep,
scratchy voice.
Scary voice.
Yeah, oh, shit.
He's a real exposition character in this.
Thomas, did thee witch thee? Yeah, he's for the son of the devil to cast a shadow across the world.
You're like, nice. Yeah, Ralph Ineson, go.
Nice.
Go get that.
And we're also going to be talking about the Netflix film Scoop, which is about the Prince Andrew Newsnight interview. Which
Prince Andrew runs a gelato parlor.
Not that kind of scoop. So look out for that later in the week. But whatever you're watching, basically, we've got it covered this week. We're covering the main stuff. James, shall we start the show? So we start the reviews. And then after which we'll do some emails and play some games. Also, I know we say this, but welcome everyone.
Oh yeah, welcome.
Welcome back. And if it's your first time listening, welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
Let's start.
Hey guys, this is a quick message brought to you in partnership with our friends at Airbnb.
So George, I just got back from a 9-day trip the other day.
Yeah, you do go away a lot.
Sorry, I do know it kind of derails production slightly, but work or otherwise, I do enjoy getting a bit of winter sun.
Mm.
I do enjoy getting out of the sort of dark, wintry London months.
Yes.
And I will be going away again in a few weeks with my family. But, I was actually speaking to my older sister about this, and for the last 2 years, she hosts her flat on Airbnb every time she goes away.
Okay.
And it got me thinking, like, why don't I do this? It seems like a really easy thing to do. I actually went to go and check what other flats in my area were going for. And I realized my home was actually worth more than I thought. This just feels like a no-brainer.
So if you were to go away now, you could host your flat on Airbnb. And when you come back, you made a little bit of extra pocket money.
Yeah, goes towards the next holiday.
Yeah, smart. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you know, I've never hosted on Airbnb, but I have stayed in an Airbnb several times. And there have been a few times when I'm thinking, the host is the same age as me. Why am I not doing what they're doing?
We should be doing this.
Yeah.
It just feels like something that would really fit into my lifestyle. But you guys could find out how much your home is worth by going to airbnb.co.uk/host.
So, Ripley,
based on the Patricia Highsmith novel, Talented Mr. Ripley, but also she has a series of novels, five Ripley novels. And obviously the most famous example we can hark back to is the original Talented Mr. Ripley movie from the late 90s with Jude Law, Matt Damon, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Which you and I hold in very high regard.
High regard.
I rewatched it two Christmases ago, completely re-fell in love with it again, and it sort of solidified itself as one of my top films.
I agree. And I think, it's definitely up there in my favourites. I think it's one of the most stylish films ever, I think.
Impossible not to just fall madly in love with Jude Law. You know, he was 2 years younger than us when he made that.
Excuse me while I shot be that. Sick. Yeah. And they made that film for, it was a tight budget. They were doing like 14-hour days. They were all exhausted. And every night, Matt Damon would go up to he was actually quite separate from the cast because he would go up to his hotel room and go on the treadmill for run 6 miles on the treadmill every night because he needed to make himself look like Jude Law.
Oh my God.
The whole thing, you need to slim himself down as much as possible.
Because Matt Damon, he's not overweight, but he has a heavier build.
He's a heavier
Jude Law.
He's a heavy build. That's most famously there. But also there have actually been several Ripley iterations from the other Ripley novels. There was actually Wim Wenders, we talked about recently from Perfect Days.
Close the window? Because I think it's the power tools. Honestly, it's spring and they just get all the power tools out. And then top window as well.
So Wim Wenders, who we talked about recently, he made a Ripley movie in 1977 called The American Friend with Dennis Hopper playing Tom Ripley. Very different. All of these iterations, very different styles. That was based off of the third Ripley novel. Then they made a Ripley movie in 2002 with John Malkovich called Ripley's Game.
Yeah.
He played Ripley then. And then there was apparently a terrible 2005 Ripley movie called Ripley Underground where Barry Pepper played Tom Ripley. Barry Pepper is the sniper in Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, yeah.
Great
name.
But a dormant franchise from very popular novels. Patricia Highsmith also was a very interesting writer. She
considered one of the great crime
murder writers. And she wrote this and Strangers on a Train. Oh, she also wrote Carol, the story that would become the movie Carol, called The Price of Salt. Anyway, the latest iteration is now out as an eight-part series.
Series episodes like 45 minutes to an hour a piece. I think, like, you know, as you said, we hold the Talented Mr. Ripley from 99 in very high regard.
I want to say, 99, 98.
Yeah, in really high regard. I'm sort of, when I heard that they were doing a Netflix miniseries adaptation looking very stylistically very differently, I think I was a little bit like, oh, don't touch it. That's one of my favorite films. I think it's near perfect with beautiful actors who do the job really well.
Iconic.
Totally iconic. Watched it recently, so it's fresh. I'm not sure. You know, even though you've got great great ingredients in there, like Andrew Scott, who I think can do no wrong at the moment, I was a little bit like, oh, I'm not ready to jump into this. Based on the novel than it is sort of a remake of any film or thing that we've seen before. If those of you who don't know, Ripley is, in this series, we find him as a sort of nomadic stranger living in New York, a scammer. He is someone who, you know, steals letters from dental practices and falsifies letters to them, claiming that they're past due on rent, trying to cash checks in banks. He's a scammer. He's an enigma.
Like almost a very, very sinister Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, totally. There is a bit of
like
that sort of
like stealing envelopes to get them out.
Numbers off of things. Yeah. And one thing that I sort of will go on to talk about later and what this series just does so well is the capturing of letters, signing, typewriter things. Everything about that is so beautifully captured in the telling of this story and information that's passed in the 1960s. 50s?
60s.
60s. So he is tasked by the father of Richard or Dickie Greenleaf, a wealthy middle class man, to bring his son home from Italy. Richard Greenleaf, he's played by
Johnny Flynn
in this series, has been living in Italy, sort of beyond his means, in a huge house. He doesn't really have any direction. He's painting, he's pursuing art, but basically his father's like, look, it's time for him to come home. And so he basically flies, gets on a boat to Italy?
We don't see how.
I
assume he would have probably got a boat, but we don't know.
Goes to Italy and travels all the way to this part of town and slowly introduces himself to Dickie, pretends to be someone who has lived in parallel to his life from New York, and slowly entwines himself into Dickie's life. He's also got a girlfriend called Marge, played by Dakota Fanning, who's, I think, really good in this and does really well. And she's very suspicious of him, and he's not upfront with the reason he's there initially. Mm. But all of a sudden, this obsession grows to mimic the life of Dickie and sort of become part of him. There's an infatuation, an obsession, a slightly subsexual, like he's wearing his clothes and posing as him, and all of a sudden it completely departs from what he was originally tasked to do.
And I think also, and, you know, yeah. do stop me, but it's also this like very much like class-based thing where, you know, when we first meet Tom Ripley in New York, he's in a crappy apartment, where, you know, really making ends meet by doing these scams.
Yeah.
And suddenly he finds himself in this position of luxury around people with wealth. He absolutely, you know, Dickie represents, yeah, absolutely idolizes everything that Dickie represents. And also is a touch of envious as well.
Yeah.
And there's this aspirational element to him. And he realizes...
culture and art and knowing things about...
Exactly. And he's almost like he arrives in Italy, meets Dickie and realizes, he's like, hold on, this is a great thing going on
there's
here.
Levels to this.
Yeah, yeah. I need to make sure I can continue
Yeah, you almost say... this is sort of... apologies for the drilling outside. It's portals. There's almost this thing where like he's pretending to elongate his stay and sending letters back to Richard's father being like, oh, you know, that money you sent, would you mind sending me a bit more so I can stay here? Because anyone would. So the first thing to notice about this is that I was slightly thrown by the difference in the age of the cast members attached to the age of certainly the Talented Mr. Ripley film and obviously the actual characters as they were written. As from what I'm aware, the characters in this novel, I think Dickie's meant to be in his mid-20s and Andrew Scott is 47, who's meant to be a similar age because they grew up together. And Johnny Flynn is, I think, in his early 40s, which sort of threw me a little bit because I was like, I think there's something about the young passion and flair of those characters to me is distinctive of people who are in their 20s.
And also the fact that Dickie is being sort of wayward in Italy, lounging about, is a very kind of 20s immaturity. It's kind of, you see that as someone characteristic in their 20s. When someone does it in their 40s, it's kind of.
And a father telling his son who's in his 40s to come home and.
How old is that father?
It's slightly strange. Yes, I've always found that slightly strange. And
I think that the series probably wants you to imagine that they are 10 years younger, even though the character is meant to be 15 years younger.
And don't get me wrong, Andrew Scott, we've talked about this on the show impeccable. Before. 47 looks fantastic. When he was doing promo for All of Us Strangers. Skin, everything just...
I know.
He's looking great. I mean, just like I am thrown by the somatic differences between people in their late 30s and in their 20s. Agreed. And that did sort of throw me. The other thing about this is that it is a noir black and white adaptation of this. And who was it who made it? It was...
Robert Elswit?
No, Steven Zeilen, who's the director, who's commented on the fact that he chose to shoot this in black and white, said, when I read the book, it had a black and white photograph on the front cover. And to me, for the rest of the time, I only pictured this series in black and white. And you and I have seen the film, which is gorgeous to look at. And you almost can't imagine sucking the colour out of that whole story. But
in that film as well, it's like, you know, the red of the Campari is jewel red, ruby red. The blue of the sea is aqua
Jude
blue.
Law's tan skin.
Yeah, the blonde, it's just, it shimmers like a film photograph.
Totally, and you're realizing that this is going for something completely different. We obviously start, you know, in New York and you're shooting the city in this very gothic noir style. Yeah. And it goes on to basically really define itself as a totally different telling of this story. It's shot by Robert Elswit, who's shot There'll Be Blood, Magnolia, Nightcrawler, and many others. It's absolutely spellbindingly gorgeous.
He's a real heavyweight cinematographer. He's great.
I just thought that, you know, looking at this, you immediately think this is a deeply gothic, black and white, noir, Hitchcockian treatment of this story. It's so definitive. It immediately, I think, differentiates itself from that
completely
film.
Completely different.
I think it's great, by the way, this series. And it goes on to prove that it is so deserving its right to exist and to tell this story in a way that I don't think that film even touched. That film still stands an incredible film, but I'm so glad this version exists. It's about 8:45 minutes to an hour long episodes, but you could watch it through like a film. I watched this in two sittings. I could not stop looking at it because it just effortlessly flowed. Wow. I became completely enraptured in Ripley as a character. And one thing that I found interesting about it is I think in the film, as audience members, we all fall in love with Dickie. We're longing for Dickie to notice us and to bring us in. And you like Ripley, become obsessed with Dickie. And in this series, I found that that's not what this series was trying to do. I don't think Johnny Flynn should necessarily be compared to Jude Law's performance because they're so different. Mm. But to me, the obsession in this series was with Ripley. Mm. You're meant to be obsessed with his every move. Because I never really got... And I think Johnny Flynn's performance did slightly leave me lacking when I'm watching this because he didn't sort of entice me. I didn't understand why I wanted to obsess with this character. I didn't fall in love with him like I did with Jude Law.
I actually think
he's a little bit... Sometimes his delivery was, well, you know, you gotta...
What are you going to do tomorrow? It's a little flat. He's very still. And it's not the same performance, but it doesn't have the same. I'm not in love with Dickie in this.
I think that. I was going to say, I noticed something like that. So just for the record, I've only seen two episodes.
Yeah.
James has seen the entire eight. But of the two episodes I've seen, I noticed that in its different aesthetic, stylistic approach, the sort of when Dickie and Tom first meet and the whole interaction, it's framed much more as sort of awkward and stilted and cold. Whereas just for comparison's sake, in the film version, it's much more romanticized, energetic, yeah. confident. And you see Matt Damon as Tom Ripley really turn on the charm. And what I noticed at first is that there wasn't actually a clear demarcation between the Ripley that we see in the shadows and the Ripley that's interacting with Dickie. It's sort of the same awkwardness. So I agree with you. I'm like, what is there about Dickie that's so enticing other than the material and the sort of, you know, the handsomeness of him to
the wealth Ripley. And everything we exactly. said before, yeah.
But also, what is so charming about Ripley to Dickie for him to want to continue to hang out with him? Because I noticed, this sounds like a criticism more than I actually...
Because there's the homoerotic element of it as well, which is unclear and left vague.
But like that first interaction when they first meet... Before you know it, they quickly cut and they're walking up the steps to the villa and they're having a drink
sort
in the villa.
Invited him for a coffee.
And I'm sort of thinking, well, hang on, what's happened there? Dickie, you've met someone that you don't actually remember who claims to know you. I suddenly find you've got to the point where you're, you know, having drinks together. Maybe because I guess you're another American, just out of politeness, another American. But I'm thinking, I don't see the charm of... Ripley. I don't see Ripley working his charm, or conversely, Dickie working his charm on Ripley to the same extent.
Yeah.
Not a major problem, but I did think that. I was like, why are these two people attracted? You know,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, totally. And structurally, this obviously, but in sort of how the story plays out, happens very differently. In the original, or in the movie of Talented Mr. Ripley, the turning point of the plot takes place about halfway through, maybe almost two-thirds of the way through. Whereas in this series, that happens way earlier. And this series really comes alive after that moment. And I think it's a good series that I was into to just being unable to stop watching and just taking off. And the devil is in every single detail that I'm so glad was played out to me so slowly. The pacing is slow. And you notice that when you first watch episode one, but that all of a sudden doesn't matter once you start getting into it, because every brushstroke, every flick of autograph and signature, every letter open, every typewriter key is given detail, and it becomes so clear as to why that detail is so important later. And it's just scintillating and evocative and just brilliant. I cannot shower this series with more compliments for how much joy it gave me. Gorgeous to look out. The details of the web of lies that is created as this thing goes on is just so captivating to see play out. And what I really like about this series, and it's true for the film as well, is that as audience members, we are given access to all the information. We know exactly what happened. We saw what happened. We've seen all the truths play out. And we're just watching great minds trying to figure out what actually happened. And that's so entertaining. Yeah. Watching them go down, dead ends and then coming back, getting the wrong information, but realizing what was true. It's so fun to have seen. It's like watching a great poker match. You know how everyone else, you know what everyone else's cards are, and you're watching them figure out. Just brilliant. The cinematography, choosing to go noir, black and white. When you shoot black and white, you get to really work with contrast, and they do it so well in this film. I always felt like everything was on the brink of discovery. Everything's on the edge of truth, the edge of death. Shining a light on what really happened is always just an edge away. And there's a specific scene later which really uses shadow and contrast, and you get a really clear sense of why they've chosen to hide things and show things. Everything that is beautiful in this series, whether it was a person, a place, a relationship, eventually gets muddied, disgusting and brutalized. And again, contrast of beauty and horror. Andrew Scott is the best actor working today after this series. He's completely spellbinding.
Do you know what's interesting about Andrew Scott is that he was a supporting actor for so long and wonderful and amazing endings, and also a very accomplished theater actor, as we've said before. And he's had two leading roles back to back now this year with All of Us Strangers and now this, and it's like it's so obvious, of course he should be the leading man and things, because he's just so interesting. I'll say, when you said about the pacing, I agree. I think it's deliberate, as is Tom Ripley. It's deliberate and meticulous, because Tom Ripley, what makes him such a compelling character, even though he is sinister and nasty, he is very smart.
Yeah.
And you love, as an audience, to follow smart people.
And to see what
they do. He's good at his craft. His craft just happens to be conning and scamming people.
Yes.
And watching that is so interesting. I think that you get totally hooked in, even, and that's what makes you squeamish, because Highsmith originally, I guess, was pulling you in with this incredible craftsmanship of Ripley's character, and then making you feel awkward and uncomfortable from
almost
what happened
for them in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why he often gets referred to as like an anti-hero in a way. And I love that. I would say that everything so far that I like about Ripley is everything I didn't like about Saltburn. And I think this is very important to bring up because we just went through Saltburn Fever, which was so big and so like, oh my God, you know, everyone obsessing about it.
And like everyone who finds out that I do a film podcast who are very casual film viewers go, oh yeah, what do you think of Saltburn? It's a question I'll get asked four times a day if someone finds out I do a film podcast, which is really interesting. Yeah. But anyway.
So on the one hand, you have Saltburn, which took heavily, more than was respectable from the talented Mr. Ripley. And Saltburn's whole aesthetic approach was excess, and it was excessive to the point because it was excessive in lieu of any depth, right?
Yeah. Now, and I think implied depth that wasn't really fleshed out.
Now, as an aesthetic approach, excess is fine. Like I said at the time,
it looks beautiful.
I like the kind of trashy excess of the late noughties. That's fine, but when you compare to something like Ripley, which is so stripped back, black and white, and deliberate and focused. I'm like, I don't need to see Andrew Scott lick Dickie's bathwater to know exactly
he's
obsessed and exactly his feeling. Everything about Ripley is they're a complete polar opposites in the way they are executed.
Exactly.
Even though they share such DNA, you don't need to use color. Yeah. You don't need to, you know, have all this grotesque excessiveness to really get us rooted in the narcissist of the story.
As well as that, there are like the cameras, and you'll notice this as you keep on watching it and you return to the same environments. They decided where the camera would be and what the angle would be for that place, and they stuck at it. And when they went back, the camera never moved. So you know, just in the first two episodes, the long stairs that go all the way up. So there's the camera that always stays in the same position, but when different characters in different situations with different stresses and moments of the day go through, you notice the difference because the camera hasn't told you exactly what to look at. And it's used so well later on when Ripley's in an apartment and there's certain things that need to be hidden and shown and certain characters can or can't see exactly what's happened. And you realize how genius the use of the camera being definitive and decisive and staying in the exact same place. And it's just, I feel like I know all of these spaces so well already, and I know exactly where was what and what was hidden. And it's just decisive and clear. And yes, you need to take your time to do that, but I'm so glad that over that amount of time, it did it. It's really well done. I just also want to say the guy who plays the inspector, who is Maurizio Lombardi, plays Inspector Ravini late in the second half of the series, I thought was fantastic, phenomenal. It felt like watching an early Christoph Waltz performance or discovering Christoph Waltz. Right, yeah. I just thought brilliant, the detail. And again, just like letters and watching a great mind try and unlock something. And I also want to give a shout out, and I'm sorry I can't name the actors, but every single hotel receptionist desk clerk in this entire series is just phenomenal. And whether it's the guy who runs the post office or just all of these people that and as I said before, the exchange of information and sending of messages is so pivotal to how everything happens in this series. And the detail that goes into the keys and the forms for the ferry, just all of those actors, there's no such thing as a small part. These guys just turned up in the best way, whether it was the very expensive Corinthia or the dingy, gross back alley hotel in Rome. All of them were just phenomenal and just brought those extra scenes alive. Highest praise from me.
And just the way also about what it's shot, it's so clear. It's drawn, particularly in the New York sequences, but it's so heavily informed by street photography in the 1950s, you know, deep black and white, like a Life magazine kind of
100%.
What's the name? Not Vivian Mayer. A bit of Vivian Mayer, but also there's a very famous American. It'll come back to me. The name of an American street photographer from the 50s and 60s, and it's very much like that. Slightly skew angles when he's getting the underground. All of it is heavily informed and stylized.
Really wonderful rules of composition, leading lines, natural spirals, rule of thirds. It's all meticulously designed.
And then when it gets to Italy, it's like it takes sort of traditional travel photography, a travel eye, and just slightly makes it a bit more sinister, you know, slightly off kilter. If you, you take the leading lines of a staircase and that, if you just slightly pitch it the other way, oh, this suddenly becomes very threatening and imposing.
So. And almost like you get to Italy coming from New York and you'll think, God, I can't believe they sucked the color out of this. But once you're in it, you know what it was like? It's like getting into a bath. The first time you jump in, you're like, oh, I'm not so sure. Not sure of the temperature here, but once you soak yourself in this series, it's great. I think if I am to criticize it, I think it maybe overstayed its welcome by an episode. It had it builds and it crescendos, and I as I said, I couldn't stop watching it, and I almost thought you should have just wrapped this up a little bit sooner. But because I had such a good time with it, I'm so glad I've seen it. And I think you and I have been very quick to criticize, or we get quite sort of down on thinking that Netflix could be guilty of commissioning content that has to immediately grab your attention and needs to be like second screen friendly and needs to, like, you know, we don't get the kind of long drawn out detail oriented series that we hope. But I'm so glad this exists, because it's so, once you start watching this, all of those concerns about being able to pay attention, being able to sort of sustain you, all those things, just all those concerns fall by the wayside once you start watching really high quality TV shows. I can't give it high enough praise. It shoots to the top of Netflix original series for me.
And what's really bizarre at the moment, it's got sort of like mixed reviews, and I'm like, people don't know a good thing when they see it.
I started it thinking like, oh, is it a bit too over-stylized? And I was like, no, this is really good.
Diane Arbus. Diane Arbus was the name of the photographer from the 1950s. But yeah, Ripley, we're big fans. And it's great because we are able to compartmentalize and love this TV series over here and still love the original film from the 90s over there.
And I'm very happy to, if you told me next Christmas we're going to watch The Terrence and Mr. Ripley, I'd so happily do it. But I could actually see myself 2-3 years down the line rewatching this series. There are so many details I want to rediscover.
If you can answer this in a non-spoiler way, do you think we will get more Ripley? Are they going to do the other novels? Because there's five novels.
I would love them to keep going. If they can recreate the magic they did in this and do more adventures of Mr. Ripley, love it. I would absolutely love that.
So, have you
friends
guys
at Netflix listening? Just do it.
Oh, I think if they need to hit, they'll do it.
Oh, that's great.
Do you know what? This does actually help stuff get commissioned. If you watch this on Netflix and you like it, do give it the double thumbs.
Yeah.
Because you need to tell Netflix that they should keep making stuff like this.
We've heard this is like really important.
It's really important. So double like it.
Double like the stuff you like on Netflix.
Anyway, that was Ripley. Let us know what you think if you've seen the show. Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Send your thoughts into hello@pulpkitchenpodcast.com.
And if you do find episode one or two a bit slow, please, I know this is like a cliche of a good series, but please stick with it. Yeah. It's really worth it. And it just comes alive in its middle section. Yeah. It's top, top quality.
Yeah. So let's do Civil War, the latest film from Alex Garland. Ex Machina, Annihilation, Men, and now Civil War, which could be his last film as director. He said...
No.
He said in an interview that he doesn't plan to make any of the other films as a director in the coming years.
Historically, a writer, wrote
28 Years Later, and
The Beach, Dread.
Yeah, I think so.
And
maybe Sunshine, I think. He collaborated a lot with Danny Boyle.
Yes.
And then he kind of branched off and became a director. But he's now said that he finds directing just very difficult, you can find his quote online, but very sort of draining, and he really he doesn't find it as fulfilling and as joyous as he does. And he will still write. He is 28 years later, is in production. Him reteaming with Danny Boyle, he's going to be writing that, and Cillian Murphy playing in the role.
It's low hanging fruit, that one. Like, that means now he's Oscar winner. Yeah.
Exactly. Civil War, though, the fourth film from Alex Garland. He also made a TV show in 2020 called Devs, which I didn't watch, but Civil War.
George just inhaled some granola in the break. The magic of editing. Can't hide your...
Civil War.
Yeah.
So, Civil War begins with an address from the President of the United States, played by Nick Offerman in this.
Great.
And in his speech, he says, he basically describes how the US is in a state of civil war against the secessionists of California and Texas, as well as some Florida secessionists, which seem to be breaking away for a different reason and in a different state. And in this presidential address, he is saying, we've won a decisive victory, one of the best military campaigns ever. The enemy is on its last knees, and we are close to defeating the secessionists from the Union.
Is it secessionists?
No, secession.
Secessionists.
To secede.
Secede, gotcha.
Is different to succeeding
gotcha,
something.
Gotcha, gotcha.
And we then cut to the sort of the main fray. And what we're realizing is what the president has said is actually not tallying with what the reality is. It seems that the Western forces of California and Texas are making very strong advances. And the equally the Florida Alliance, I think that's what it is also making gains. We follow in Civil War a band of photojournalists and journalists and photojournalists together. And I should begin my review of Civil War by saying it isn't the film you think it is. Okay. Right. That's really important to say, because I think this film might catch a lot of people off guard with its focus and what its intent. This film is called Civil War. It's being marketed as a war film. Very Apocalypse Now theme sort of posters.
Helicopters guns being
that
fired
shot's
into the sky.
Not in the film, you know.
Really?
The close-up of the Empire State torch with snipers in there, that's not in the film.
How interesting.
This is actually much more a film.
Because there are bits of it that look like Modern Warfare 2 when they nuke the White House. In the trailer, there's a shot.
There are elements, but like really, this is a film much more interested and focused and centered on journalism and photojournalism. We follow Kirsten Dunst. Kirsten, not Kirsten, by the way. I know that because Tom Wilkinson said it in an interview on the radio 10 years ago. And when Kirsten Dunst was at the screening I was at, and when they introduced her onto stage, they said, please welcome Kirsten Dunst. So Kirsten, not Kirsten, there you go. Kirsten Dunst plays a renowned war photographer who's been sort of seasoned and embattled and kind of numb to the conflict around her. She is partnered with a journalist played by Wagner Moura from Narcos, who played Pablo Escobar so brilliantly, Brazilian actor, Wagner Moura. And when he turned up in this, I was like, yes. I was like, you're a great actor, but we don't see enough of you in the English-speaking film world. Yeah. Like, it's great to have you in this, and he's really, really good. Nice. They at the beginning of the film, are at a hotel in New York, and New York is a place where it's still functioning as a city, but there is very much an armored presence. There is civil discontent. There is a brawl outside a water truck for rations. So, you know, society is being frayed. At the sort of press center at this hotel, where they also speak with a much older journalist played by Stephen McKinley Henderson. People will know from Dune Part One, Lady Bird. He's almost like a representative of the kind of old journalistic guard, you know, the kind of all the president's men type of journalism. They meet a much younger and budding photojournalist played by Kaylee Spenny from Priscilla and the soon-to-be Alien film directed by Fede Alvarez later this year.
Priscilla.
Right, and she's in this. And the thing is about Kaylee Spenny is that she's actually like 23 and her character in this is meant to be 23, but she looks about 14. And this kind of youthful, so you have this very young, timid, youthful presence amidst all this kind of very adult conflict. And early on, Kirsten Dunst and Wagner Moura revealed to their journalist colleague, they say, we're actually planning to drive to DC because the front line is being pushed back and they're like, she wants to get a photo of the president and he wants to get an interview with the president before they believe the Western forces are going to get to the president and they're going to execute him. You know, the film is very much informed by like, kind of like dictatorships. You know, they talk about Gaddafi, they talk about Saddam, they talk about Ceausescu. It's like, this is very much informed by actual history. So they are planning to embark on a road trip to drive to DC, through which gets them very close to the front line. Stephen McKinley Henderson asked to come along, even though he's a walking risk. He's incredibly slow, he's older, putting him in a combat situation is not advised. And who also gets themselves onto this trip is Kaylee Spenny's budding journalist. And the four of them are this kind of ragtag team who then drive in a press van through the altered United States, a United States that is in the throes of the titular Civil War as they head themselves to DC. It's a road movie, basically. Okay. So as I said before, the first thing to say about Civil War, whatever you think about it, it is not the film you think it is. Like I said, it is much more focused on journalism. The Civil War of the title, the Civil War that's being really billed to you and marketed to you, is very much background. It is the Civil War to this movie is what the monsters are to Gareth Edwards' monsters. If anyone ever saw that movie, it's like very much in the background, but that's actually about like a, you know, escaping from Mexico and like a relationship between two people. That's kind of what's happening here. Beautifully shot, and you have moments and recreations of this kind of altered America. It looks like present day, although there's one line that makes you think it could be set 10, 15 years in the future. So the film is about journalism and the pursuit of truth and the validity of that. And this kind of, specifically with photojournalism, walking this line of being of objective reportage and also adrenaline thrill seeking. Are you being complicit in perpetuating people's obsession with war? And there's kind of, you could do kind of a deeper reading about America's obsession with military, with war, with guns, with power. And are you, as a photojournalist, fetishizing war? Are you aestheticizing it? Are you getting a little thrill out of it? Are you getting addicted to it? And you do kind of have this kind of waning parallel between Kaylee Spenny's character as she kind of assumes more and more and gets sucked into the photojournalism more, while Kirsten Dunst is becoming more and more embittered by it. The recreation of any scenes of sort of action or war are actually quite few and far between, but the moments of war photography that are recreated, so for example, you'll see them take a shot and then it'll show you the shot that they've just taken, the black and white photography, is very evocative and very startling. You and I both like photography, and as we were just saying with Ripley, like the recreation of the black and white war photography in this is really startling. You know, if anyone knows the work of like Don McCullen, this is really informed by that, and that's quite interesting to see. I think I should probably just say I was quite underwhelmed by Civil War. Actually, I was disappointed, which is a real shame because I think it's got really good ingredients, and it's made by a director who's made some interesting work. And I'm starting to get the impression Alex Garland writes and directs movies around an interesting concept, but always doesn't quite stick the landing with them. So with a film like Men, for me, the first two thirds work quite well as a kind of a thriller, as a horror film, but then it completely just goes crazy in the third act. Yeah. And any sort of like deeper level about men or women versus men, I think, is really kind of not
bad title for that film.
I think it
invites more questions than the film, I think, needs to answer.
And that's exactly what's happening here. Right. I think calling it Civil War invites you to think that it's about polarized America. And when I first saw this coming out, I thought, well, actually, that's got its finger on the pulse. Actually, it's a bit too much. It's quite on the nose calling it Civil War. America is incredibly divided at the moment. It's incredibly politicized, incredibly polarized. And I thought, okay, here comes a film that's going to imagine the extension of that in a few years'
common
time.
Common narratives that we're heading towards the Civil War, right? About the insurrection of the White House, like following that.
Exactly.
Right? Very pointed title.
And I think this film sidesteps that. And I actually, one half of me, I do respect their decision to do that, because that is such a minefield and is such a dangerous line to walk that I understand if they go, you know, we're actually going to put that in the background, we're actually going to focus on these characters in the foreground. But the problem is, you do feel a little bit teased because you've been invited to a film called Civil War. You think you're going to see a film that's really going to tackle this issue in a time that's about America being so polarized. And it's like, yeah, it's in the background. I mean, I've seen people comment on this film saying, oh, it's a film that really like grabs you and asks the important questions and doesn't let go. And I'm like, I'm really sorry. I don't actually think that. So that's the first thing. It's not really about Civil War. That's very much in the background, and it's not about polarized America as much as it really should be for a film called Civil War in an era when America is not too far away from something like Civil War. There are horrific moments and horrific images, and like I said, anyone familiar with war photography, they won't be surprised. But I think one of the biggest problems is that it doesn't make me think. There's nothing in this film that actually made me think. There's nothing that made me feel deeply uncomfortable or got under my skin. When you're watching something like this, again, that should be close to the mark and have its finger on the pulse, you should feel uncomfortable. You should feel knotty. You should feel a little bit sweaty. And it doesn't do that. There's nothing shocking in this film that isn't on the news every day.
I'm so depressing.
I'm really sorry to say, but there is stuff on the news every day that is much more shocking and thought-provoking and horrific than what's going on in Civil War. And actually, sorry, just to finish my point I just mentioned about Alex Garland, it's like, so men, like first two thirds of Jim Falls Apart, Annihilation, here and there, great sort of last half an hour, I think. Yeah. And with Civil War as a whole structure, I would say, I think the first two thirds are fairly humdrum. I'll get on to say this, but I think the third act kind of picks it up a little bit.
Ex Machina is a film that I think
I think that's
his best film, and I think
I agree.
He's consistently good all the way through.
I think it's observations are fairly pedestrian. I think it's not really, like I said, there's not a lot of depth to it as much as you would expect or want for a film like this. And like I said, go on the news every day, you'll get much more than this film is giving you. I actually think there's a comparison to make with a really good, I think it was a Colombian film from 5 years ago called Monos. Mm. Now, Monos is fairly similar because that imagined a hypothetical civil war in an unnamed South American country, although clearly very much informed by Colombia. And it was about a group of child soldiers up in the mountains. And even though that was about a fictional civil war, that film did really well at making you feel uncomfortable because of the age of the children that, you know, that they were dealing with and about the dynamics and effects of war. And I think that was a much better thought exercise and aesthetic exercise. I mean, Monos is a really, really good film. But I'm like, that was a better imagination and exploration of a hypothetical civil war than this film does. You know, like I said, great moments here and there, and it's interesting passingly. It has a quite annoying use of upbeat pop music to horrific imagery. And I'm a bit like, we have seen that many, many times, Alex. Yeah. Come on, is that the best we can do? The third act is great. Is much better. The third act really ramps up the action, the tension, and the kind of the stakes, and is very, very heavily informed, like I kind of said earlier, by history. And you kind of do feel like what you're watching here, history in motion. But I can't say that it delivers a punch at the end that makes me go, oh, wow. Again, it doesn't make you think, this film. That's the biggest problem. It doesn't make you think. Mm. You might go, oh, that's passingly interesting. There's a moment here or there, and some of the action is very sort of taut and tense, but I was quite underwhelmed with it in that respect. So not the film you think it is, not that deep, doesn't make you think, everything on the news is scarier than what's going on in this, and third act is better and kind of makes it a little bit worthwhile. It kind of saves the film, I think, the third act. But yeah, I was disappointed.
I almost feel like calling your film Civil War and like Civil War. Mm. I do go in there thinking you've created a really hard problem to solve or answer.
Pitch yourself into a corner.
I'm not saying you have to do that when you make that film, but almost you're inviting a lot of, given that, like, I don't know how you want, what incident you want to call in American news that you're relating that to and want clearly trying to draw from. It's making it very difficult for you to make a statement without diverting from it. And therefore, as you said, feeling like you were slightly teased or misdirected towards what this film's saying.
But they're putting this film in IMAX. They're like, yeah, go see Civil War. And I'm like, I think, again, that's misleading people that they're going to see Apocalypse Now. They're not.
Yeah. Because I think they just think, oh, big film, shot big with action. We can make a few extra bucks on the cinema ticket. I still stand by, like, I really like the mind of Alex Garland. And as you said, I agree with you on all the films you said where the landing wasn't quite stuck. But he has a really sort of dark and slightly twisted way of looking at the world. And I will go and see the film because he's a bit of a draw for me. But yeah, I did have that. I didn't really know where to place this from the marketing. And I've heard mixed things from different people.
I will say, I'm still glad this film got made and this film exists. Because ultimately, you know, I know it's A24. You can't almost really call them an independent company anymore. They're so big. Yeah. But I'm still grateful for the fact that a sort of... you know, a director, an independent director, can make a movie that tries to tackle a bigger thing.
Original IP.
Original IP, exactly. Yeah. All of those things for what's probably a modest budget.
Yeah.
I'm still happy that exists. It's got a kind of very 1970s American New Wave kind of feel about it. I'm happy for that. Yeah. But I think people will be disappointed.
Got... husband, wife duo, Jesse Plemons, Kirsten Dunst.
Not much of Jesse Plemons. I'm just going to say that now as well. It's not a Jesse Plemons movie.
Oh,
it's a Kirsten Dunst movie.
He's my favorite.
He's good at everything. He's in it. Like, he's like with Nick Offerman and Jesse Plemons. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah, fine. Okay. Well, yeah, I will be interested to see what you guys think of it, because as we said, there's lots of different opinions out there. So as always, if you wanted to send them in, if you agree or disagree with George, or just had different thoughts, questions, concerns, send them in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. We'll read them out on the show. Maybe we'll read them out when I go and see it, and maybe in a week.
Yeah, that's it. We can actually talk about it.
We can comment on it and get other people to chime in.
I'd love it to provoke more of a conversation, this film, but I really... I'm a pretty good read of how the rest of an audience feels about something. Yeah. And I think the audience felt a bit like me, just sat in kind of bemused silence, being like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That was the film. Also, Alex Garland, I mean, I know he's just said that he probably won't make any more films. He did sound very depressed really? When he got on stage. He was like, yep, thanks for coming to this thing.
He's very subdued.
Maybe he's playing it cool. Yeah. But again, Alex Garland, I wish you would make more films. I'm still happy for you to be making films.
Men Only came out not that long ago to have done this. And
yes, because he wrote the script for this pre-COVID. He sent it to the producers February 2020.
It's quite a fast turnaround. So also,
this is the other thing. I'm wondering if for a film to have its finger on the pulse, it kind of dates. Because if this film was written pre January 6th, insurrection... now it's just got so true.
And
it's
coming
out in an election year as well. It's just...
It's probably why it got commissioned. It's very easy to sell.
That's the thing. It's a bit of a bait and switch, this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, let us know what you think.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
George, should we go through some of the emails that we get sent into the show every single week? If you guys wanted to send in your reviews, your thoughts, your questions, your concerns, you can, of course, send them in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. Just...
like
Noreen did. Noreen writes in and says, hello. First off, let me say I'm a huge fan of the podcast. Listen every week and glad I discovered Pulp Kitchen last year. Keep up the good work. I'm writing this immediately after listening to your review of Monkey Man, which I just saw this evening. Please go and check out George's review from last week. Witnessing this project from Dev Patel has made me so proud to be a fellow South Asian, and I can't wait to see what he does in the future. Brackets, petition for Dev Patel to be James Bond if it doesn't work out with Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Oh, that's not bad.
Would that work?
He's handsome. He's young. He's at that level of fame. But he's doing his own stuff now. Like, you can own your own work.
He's just done his own James Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was gripped from start to finish of Monkey Man, from the story of revenge to the cinematography and the way the camera would focus solely on his face so you could see the intensity of his emotion. A couple of my favourite scenes was the massive brawl in the brothel to the tune of Bollywood song Ooh La La, which is from The Dirty Picture, which is a biographical film about an Indian actress noted for her erotic roles. Iconic. And also the scene where Dev Patel's character is training with the boxing bag to the man playing tabla. Going into the film, I was aware that there would be subtle nods to the current Indian political climate and Modi's leadership and his treatment to minorities in India. I had heard that the Netflix release didn't happen because of the satire approach to Indian politics, and wonder what the original edit may have been like before Jordan Peele got on board. One thing I also spotted was in the Bougie Club, which had portraits of Indian Maharajas. There was a particular focus on Maharaja Duleep Singha, whose life is too much to go into. In short, he took the throne at the age of 5, befriended Queen Victoria, converted from Sikhism to Christianity, and was the last to process the Koh-i-Noor diamond after Britain took possession of it after a war between the Sikhs and Britain. I wonder if this focus on Duleep Singha was deliberate, especially when it comes to Sikhs as a minority in India and the farmer protests in the Punjab region. Just before I go on,
I cannot speak on that, but thank you so much for filling thank in you very all much. Of that history.
Again, we can't speak. That's I can't great. Comment on that, but that's great to know.
So interesting to know. Also, it goes on to say, also interesting to know, as the assumption was that it was filmed in Mumbai, but after sticking around for the credits until the end, Monkey Man was actually filmed in Indonesia. Finally, as I write this from Adelaide, Australia, where Dev Patel has become an honorary Adelaidean, as he spends a lot of his time here, I hope he gets his flowers for this film. And thanks again for Pop Kitchen, as someone who makes an effort to go to the cinema usually twice a week. The podcast is a great companion and quickly become my number one film podcast, Noreen. Thank you for that email.
Thank you, Noreen. Very in-depth. And you're helping, you know, substantiate elements that we aren't able to comment on ourselves. So I really appreciate that.
That was great. A little bit of history for you there. Diamonds and kings and emperors and Queen Victoria.
If that is all in there, then great for Dev Patel.
Fantastic.
To put that in. Another email about Monkey Man is from Robert, who says, hello, I hope both of yous are doing well. Another Irish listener, do you think?
Probably, yeah.
Long-time listener, viewer of the podcast, and have thought about writing in plenty of times, but never thought what to say until now. I thought George's review of Monkey Man was great and was pretty spot on. I saw Monkey Man a few days early and really enjoyed it. It's chaotic and has such high energy with an artistic and visual style to which I thought Dev delivers really, really well. The camera work is probably the highlight for me. Some of the shots were amazing and the camera in those fight scenes is always moving, which sometimes I thought Patel was just doing too much and took it a little too far because it all became a little bit distracting for me because I wish he'd just kept the camera still for once. Yeah, there's a few times I'm just like, just stop taking the camera, please.
It is a fine balance to try to make that work.
Can we have three less shakes in this scene, please? Yeah. Also, I'd probably say Monkey Man is closer to Jordan Peele's brand of open-ended allegorical political cinema. But what Patel does well is use the aesthetic and the narrative to showcase the divide between people of different classes. Hey, very good. Either. Now, I know George really likes The Talented Mr. Ripley, so does James. And so does I, says Robert. And I was just curious to know if you'd be watching the TV series Ripley. Well, you're in the right episode, Robert, because we just reviewed it. There you go. Anyway, lads, you don't have to read all of this. Love the pod. Keep it up. Have a good one, Rob.
This next last bit about Monkey Man is from Nick, who writes, a friend of the show, Nick, says, greetings, gentlemen. I saw Monkey Man last evening and I did enjoy the film, but I do feel like the direction and style grew with Dev Patel's character. As Kid is getting overpowered in fights at the beginning, I feel the direction sometimes comes across as a bit all over the place, but as the character learns to fight, Dev Patel really stands out as a director and the fights feel more slick and less close up and shaky, but overall quite enjoyable. Also, my friends and I coined a new term for the latest trend in films, which is applicable to Monkey Man and Love Lies Bleeding, which is going full A24.
Even though Monkey Man is not an A24 movie.
Yeah, I guess it's like that scorched neon, high production value, but more intimate thematic story.
Yeah.
I don't know what quality you want to go on it. An interesting and grounded story, it goes on to say, an interesting and grounded story, but then going overly surreal and often supernatural. How do we feel about this? Keep up the good work. From your self-appointed Australian correspondent, Nick.
Thank you, Nick.
There is definitely a quality to them and style.
It's like mid-budget movie, small mid-budget movie that's amped up.
Artistically inclined, budget.
It's artistically inclined, but given steroids. I mean, literally in the case of Love Lies Bleeding. Yeah, I mean, Monkey Man doesn't delve into surreal and supernatural in the way that Love Lies Bleeding just goes off on. I'm interested to see when you see that. I assume you're going to see it, will you?
Love Lies Bleeding. Yeah, I would like to. Yeah. I saw a trailer for it yesterday.
Yeah, I'm interested to know what you think about it. But that goes off on one. Thank you, Nick. This next email now from Josh is, hi, James and George, or George and James. I'm Josh, a fairly new listener and a first-time emailer.
Welcome.
Welcome to the show. My local cinema is a very historic one. Oh. The Curzon in Clevedon, not far from Bristol.
Nice.
Not related to the Curzon cinema chain. It's been running since 1912.
Whoa.
And is absolutely gorgeous to be in, despite only having one small screen and showing the variety of and not showing the variety of films you can expect at the other cinemas. I feel very lucky to have such a cool place of UK cinema history near me. My question is whether you've ever visited any historic cinemas or places of film interest, and whether you think it's worth sacrificing the quality of the sound and the screen, etc., for a brilliant venue. As much as I love it, I am looking forward to moving out for uni in Oxford and being able to see a wider range of films.
Yeah.
Love the pod and spend most of my time adding the films you recommend to my ever-growing watch list. Nice. And I hope they'll be coming up on streaming soon. So James, have you ever visited any historic cinemas or places of film interest?
I mean, like outside of the Prince Charles, which is old, but I can't say I've visited loads of really old cinemas.
Did you ever go to the Duke of York's cinema in Brighton when we were there?
Near me.
Oh, yes, I did. Not the one in the lanes, not the Commedia one. The Duke of York's really old. It's like an old picture house.
I'm going to say no.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be my answer. Yeah. That got hit hard by COVID. I just want to check if it's still Duke of York's Brighton. Oh, good, it is still up. The Duke of York's picture house in Brighton is a very old picture house, and I saw good things for you there. And the sound and stuff was good there. I liked that.
The Castle Cinema in Homerton I went to recently. That's really nice. Very old, sort of like proscenium arch style, loungy seats. I saw Infinity Pool there.
Oh, yeah.
Which was, you know, boutique-y.
Have you ever been to the Electric Cinema in Notting Hill? So I'm just going to look up here, which it looks gorgeous inside. I've never been to.
No, but I know of it.
I'm just going to show you.
I was there recently, outside on the street.
I'm going to show you a picture of it, James.
I was watching people. Like
proper
artists,
you know.
Lovely.
So that's probably it for our answers. I mean, have you ever been to any like film locations? Like, you know, this is historically significant because such and such was filmed here.
Oh, probably.
But not off the top of your head.
I mean, like, yeah, but nothing that's nothing remarkable. Like,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Moving on. Thank you.
Next email is from James, who writes into the show and says, "Hi both. I was looking for James Acaster impressions, was recommended your podcast, which didn't disappoint, and ended up sticking around for the great film chat.
Hey.
With an imminent relocation from the UK to Canada on the horizon for me and my family, I was wondering if you had any recommendations for films set there. I know it's massive, but anywhere within Canada will do. Looking to drum up excitement for my wife and kids, who are less thrilled and slightly apprehensive about the move at the moment. Keep up the great work, James."
Well, we have some Canadian listeners. And in fact, if there are any Canadian listeners listening right now, please email in great films about Canada.
Yeah.
I can't... I've got two
of
my head.
I can't.
I've got,
go on.
Is Goon with Sean William Scott and Jay Baruchel, is that...
must be.
I assume because it's about must ice be. Hockey, it must be Canadian. Blackberry is a Canadian film. It's set in Waterloo in Canada. That was a Canadian company with a Canadian story. Nice. Blackberry, I would say.
I hear the film we haven't seen, Alcin D, Denis Villeneuve's,
set
in Canada.
Is that Quebec? Yeah, it must be French Canada.
Yeah.
French Canadia. Is there anything
John,
else?
Hi.
Canada.
Oh, South Park, Bigger, Longer and Uncut. big Canada scene in there. Is it in the Simpsons movie, they move to Alaska, not Canada? It's Alaska, isn't it? Yeah.
I've only seen... I've been given loads of films that are filmed in Canada or have Canadian actors in, but I mean, what is wrong with Google? All Quiet on the Western Front is not a Canadian film, okay? Like, come on. Anyway.
There must have been one thing they did in Canada that Google's like, yeah, well, this... They filmed something.
This next email. Also, good luck with the move to Canada, by the way, on that one.
Yeah. Fargo, almost.
Fargo's
close.
Montana, isn't it, I think?
Minnesota,
yeah. That's it. Right, it's the other side.
Yeah. Stone's throw.
I'll tell you what you can do. Bruce Almighty, because he goes to Niagara Falls, which is on the border with Canada. Next email
back
is...
Back to you, fuckers.
Next email is... By the way, I would say our show has a 12A rating and that we swear once.
You get one
F word.
Yeah. Kids are fine. Yeah.
Isaac Roberts says, "Hi guys, brand new to this podcast and I'm so happy I found it as I was literally trying to find this exact style of podcast for films." Well, you came to the right place. "I just listened to episode 121 and I absolutely love the answer to if the podcast had changed your love of films. Saying that going to the cinema is surrendering yourself to the cinema's rules and timescale is practically poetry. Loved every bit." Oh,
that's great.
Thank you. Well, I should probably clip that and put it on social media.
Yeah.
"However, my question is, you said how everyone must follow the cinema rules and be quiet. Well, what is the most annoying thing you have experienced in the cinema with other people and how do you handle it? For example, I hate people on their phone with a bright light."
Yeah, that's
mine. "I solve this by shooting popcorn kernels at them through my straw, only if it's getting out of hand and super distracting. Again, love the podcast and I'm listening to you everyone day by day. Thanks, Isaac." First of all, great way of handling it, shooting popcorn at them if they've got their phone out. Yeah. Phone brightness, it has almost superseded talking in the cinema now. A slight murmuring, I always have to just take, but a bright light.
And like on maximum brightness. The phones get brighter every year as well.
I told the story before on the show, but when James and I went to see Avengers Endgame 5 years ago, we were at the top of this cinema. And
which subjects you to higher chance of seeing people with
phones. Which is why when I typically choose my seats in the cinema, I go, I want to be away from people. Yeah. I'd happily even go like row B. Just even if I have to crane my neck.
Yeah, I don't want to know that I'm with other people in the room.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There was a guy in row B, full brightness, we could all sit. And James, to his credit, got up, walked all the way down the stairs, went up to the guy and was, what did you say?
I was like, "Can you turn your phone screen down? It's really distracting."
Yeah, and he did. He turned
and
his phone
And then I have this way of like, I'll say something really clear, short and definitive and then just stare at them. And then I'll leave. You know, you just linger.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's really distracting.
I mean,
and then I leave.
Yes,
but in my head, what's really annoying, and it's probably really toxic, I have like a three strikes and you're getting spoken to rule.
Yeah.
So like, if they're behind me,
ugh, yeah,
they get look. What's going? Something must be happening for you to be talking. And then you get the second strike is prolonged look, and I wait for eye contact.
Yeah.
And then I turn around and I get eye contact. Nice. And then the third one is I'll go and say something.
What would you say? I would just go. So see, I didn't. We probably had this differently. I would say, sorry guys, do you mind? Because you sound almost polite.
Yeah.
But you're saying
classic
sorry.
Classic Britain start with a sorry.
So, yeah. Sorry guys, do you mind?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. I've had on my row, I've had a father and a son. The son is talking a lot, which I'm quite forgiving of, but the dad is like indulging it and talking and all of this stuff. And I've had to, you know, I'm not talking to the kid, I'm talking to
how was
like,
the kid?
I want to say 9, 10.
Right.
Like not so young, but kind old of, enough. I think old enough to be sat to quietly and still at the cinema. And it's just been like long times that I've made eye contact and then I'll be like, I went over, I was like, hi, you guys are being really loud. I'm trying to watch the film.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it totally solves it.
A lot of people, you know, some people might tell you to F off, but I mean, that's not what that's happened, but some people are going to be loud regardless. I think also one thing I wish I'd done one time is move. Don't be afraid to move seats, especially if you're in a half empty cinema.
And it becomes less about like, should you or shouldn't you? It's more that I am like completely out of this film now because all I can hear is the talking, or all I can see is the phone screen.
Yeah.
And like, I've paid money and taken myself out to get that experience where I'm in the black box.
I think also it's like, what's annoying is if someone's on their phone screen like eight rows down in the middle and you can't get to them like you could with that person. But I think it's like if you need the loo in the middle of a film. If you just sit and think and try and ignore it, it's going to distract you because your brain's going to be thinking, you either go and deal with it.
Last night I had that.
You're like, you either go and deal with it and just tell them and you'll probably feel better about it. Then you won't be just distracted. I also think that sometimes people get embarrassed. They think they're just talking at normal length. If you go over and go, guys, could you stop talking?
Yeah.
They're going to get so embarrassed because they feel like all the eyes are on there.
The worst one was teenage girls taking flash selfies themselves in the seat. They were like, in a similar to the Endgame one, they were like sitting right at the front. I just couldn't believe that they thought, they're like 15, 16, that they thought it's okay or funny to like turn your phone and flash. And that to be like, I was like, guys, like, what are you doing? You're taking flash photos. It's really distracting.
When I saw Incredibles,
I held eye contact.
That's the way to do it. When I saw Incredibles 2, nothing to do, but just two young toddlers just running, screaming around the front.
Oh, yeah, terrible.
Like, you can't use this as a way of just dumping your children to.
No. And there are kids kid friendly screenings where you can take like babies, infants, but that's not what this is. It's not Frozen with the sing along.
Yeah, I mean, anyway. But yeah, don't be afraid. If you need to tell people to be quiet, just go up to them. Most people will be shocked and quietened down.
Yeah. Also, and just like, know really clearly what the rules are.
Also, if someone also does turn around and give you hell for it, makes you can go and get a member of staff then.
Yeah.
And it's their job.
That's so uncool. I know. You can.
Why? Just on that. Just when people are that badly behaved and stuff, I'm just like, why have you come?
Yeah.
Why have you come?
Why are you spending your money here? What are you doing? Go watch it at home. And it's like, obviously people can talk and things happen and people open crisps, and I'm not saying you react to everything, but like I am aware of who is consistently really pissing me off.
I was really happy at my screening of Monkey Man because, first of all, it was a very well-behaved audience, but the people behind me, this couple, they were chatting away before the film started, even a bit through the trailers. That's absolutely fine. And then, like all good cinema goers, as soon as the film started, not a peep.
Yeah.
Not a peep.
Like, you know, we went to see Dune Part 2, big, full IMAX screening, lots of energy, after work, drinks, everyone's buzzing. But once the film, it's all like, I think, a very sort of knowledgeable, frequent cinema attending crowd. And as soon as the film started, it was silent.
Yeah.
Laughter when it was funny. But no, there's no problems there.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, bit of a tangent.
Bit of a rant.
Watch out for us because we're out there.
You're somebody's going to be in the cinema, they're going to look up and just see you staring at them.
Have you seen that meme, which is the ostrich with its head tilted?
Oh, a little
and
bit,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
when the teacher, when you've been talking and the teacher catches your eye. That's me at the cinema. But anyway, those are the emails. Thank you so much writing them in. As always, if you wanted to send in your reviews, your thoughts, your emails, your questions, your concerns, send them into hello@popculturepodcast.com. And we'll read them out on next week's episode. Should we play a game?
I'd love to. Thank you.
All right, George, as always, let's end...
With a game.
I've got two games for you. I've got a...
How many rounds?
Name. You got one round of each game.
Got it.
That was on to you. You got one round of name three in 6 seconds.
Okay.
George is going to be presented with a brief, and he's got to name with three of the films or characters or pieces within 6 seconds. And the next one is a classic favourite, opposite film titles. Good love fun. Got to love them. Right, are you ready for your name three in six round?
Please
feel free.
Shasha, let's play at home. Warm up the brain cells.
So if I said, for example, I'd be, George, name me three Richard Gere films, you would say?
Pretty Woman, Arbitrage.
Yeah.
And The Runaway Jury, is he in that? Runaway Bride.
Nice, that would be correct. Right, George, are you ready?
Let's do it.
Please play along at home. Name me three Jennifer Aniston movies.
Along Came Polly, We Are the Millers,
yep.
And Wanderlust.
Yes. Name three films where a character eats dessert.
Inglourious Basterds.
Yes.
The Matrix Revolutions.
Yeah. Reloaded.
No. Well, sure. Yep. Merovingian. And for that delay, we're going to have to refer to Chocolat.
Yeah, very good. I had two of those same ones. Name three Marvel films that have yet to be released.
Deadpool 3.
Yeah.
Fantastic Four.
Yes.
And Avengers Secret Wars.
Sure. Name three Jason Alexander movies.
Shallow Hal.
Yes.
Pretty Woman.
Yes.
Oh, he's got to be the voice in something, hasn't he?
Yes.
Oh, the voice in...
No, out of time. Name three films that released in 2020.
That actually came out in 2020. Yes. Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yeah.
The Vast of Night. And Wonder Woman 1984.
I believe you. Name three characters that died and came back to life.
Ever. Matrix Neo. Matrix 1, Neo.
Yes.
The Passion of the Christ. No,
I'll count it.
And
that's probably time.
Hugh Wolverine, Logan, yeah, Deadpool's
a good one. Yeah, I'll give it to you. So that's the where characters eat dessert. I put Inglourious Basterds. The cake is Matrix Reloaded.
No, is that the one where
the Merovingian's Reloaded?
I'm sure. Is that when they go to the restaurant and he's
that is Matrix 2.
Okay, I'm guaranteeing it's Matrix 3.
I'll bet you 100% it's Matrix 2.
What's 100%? 100% of what?
I remember just really know it's Matrix 2 because the following scene from that is the highway chase.
No, the scene for the highway chase is the fight in the chateau.
It's right. Matrix 2. Yeah, Google it. Merovingian cake scene is Matrix 2. Brilliant scene.
It's Reloaded.
This scene. Right? This scene here, right? Yeah?
Yes.
Right?
Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah, it's Matrix Reloaded, isn't it? That's all right. Yeah, it's Matrix Reloaded.
I'm
really confident it's Matrix Reloaded.
No.
Because the fight in the Merovingian's mansion, the whole chateau thing, is his place. And then he kisses Monica Bellucci afterwards because she thinks he's fit. She wants the taste of her lips of love on hers. It's so hot.
Okay, we need to get to the bottom of this. Just
bear with me. Matrix Reloaded. People at home are screaming Matrix Reloaded.
Oh yeah, it's all right, it's Reloaded. Fair enough. I don't know why part of my brain had put that in Revolutions in my head.
Sorry. So yeah, you've got, I did Inglourious Basterds, Matrix Reloaded, and then my third option was Matilda, the Boost Bog Trotter cake.
Okay.
That's quite a famous
one. That's right. I said chocolate, I'm pretty sure there's dessert.
There must be.
Yeah, it's chocolate.
Surely.
That counts.
Yeah, and then I was thinking you could order a safe bet as chef, because they must eat dessert somewhere in that film, but I can't remember exactly
Wonka,
what.
Willy Wonka.
Oh, God, yeah. Damn. Wonka, yeah, well, there you go. Name three Marvel films yet to be released. You got them. I put this Captain America Brave New World, Fantastic Four, and Avengers, whatever. And Deadpool. Three Jason Alexander movies. It's quite hard. So you got my two, which are Shallow Hal and Pretty Woman, and then my voice of is he voices one of the gargoyles in The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, goodness.
Which I only know because I rewatched that recently. Strangely dark film.
Never seen it.
It's deeply inappropriate to be a child's film. It's so strange.
Oh, wow.
If you know, you know. I'm not going to go into it. Three films that released in 2020. That's quite hard to do.
So I know Portrait of a Lady on Fire because I saw it at the cinema.
Yeah.
I should have said Tenet. That would have been a good one.
So Tenet's on my list.
I said The Vast of Night because it came out on Prime and I remember watching it in lockdown.
Yeah.
And the other one I said, come on, was another one. I got that one.
I don't remember what you said. I just one I hadn't heard of, maybe.
But anyway, I put, so Tenet's a big one, famously, that released in 2020.
Oh, Wonder Woman 1984. That did come out in December that year.
There's Trial of the Chicago 7 came out. That's great. Yes. Really love that film. Greyhound with Tom Hanks.
Yes,
on Apple
I saw
TV
that
Plus.
As well, yeah.
The Invisible Man with Elizabeth.
Yes.
What's Moss, face?
Yeah, but I heard that was really good.
Yeah, I've not seen it. The Courier with Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley that was really forgotten about. And I know it came out in 2020 because lockdown happened and there were posters all over the tube for that film. And nobody was replacing the tube posters because nobody wanted to pay money to advertise on the tube because no one was using it. And for like a year and a half, you saw posters for The Courier, which had been out 18 months ago. I'm like, oh God, the advertising's not being replaced. Yeah, and Another Round with Mads Mikkelsen, which I've heard really good things about, but I haven't seen. Three characters that died and came back to life. Superman in the recent Justice League.
Sure, yeah.
Trinity and Neo in The Matrix, yes, both count.
Jesus.
Jesus Christ, obviously. Obviously, all the characters in Marvel, but I would have only accepted one.
Sure.
Harry Potter.
Sure.
Rey.
The boy who lived.
Yeah, come to die. Yeah, so there you go. Great. Very well done. Final one. This is for
movie opposites.
Great fun. I'm going to give George the opposite movie title, the antonyms of the words, and George has to tell me in quick fire what film I am talking about. George, are you ready?
Sure.
You have to guess the film from its opposite film title. Tame, Tame East.
Tame, Tame East West. Tame, Tame East, something, something West. Something, something West. Tame, harsh, harsh west.
Wild, wild west. The moon is sufficient.
The world is not enough. We've definitely had that one before.
Peace of the moons.
War of the worlds.
Yes. Chocolate earth.
Chocolate earth. Sun. Sun? Chocolate. Chocolate opposite of chocolate. Biscuit. Crisp.
Vanilla sky. The continent.
The continent. The country. The national. The international. The nation.
The island.
Virtue town. Virtue Town, Virtue City, Asteroid, no, City, Virtue City, Virtue, Sin City.
Yes, the variable warrior.
The warrior, coward.
The constant gardener, that's hard. Shame and fairness.
Shame and fairness. Shame, pride, yes. And prejudice.
Yes. Out of the calm.
Into the... Blue, chaos, wild.
Yes. The silver protractor.
The golden compass.
Yeah, that's it. That's all done. They're good.
Yes, God. Yes.
Wild ones, isn't there? Especially get Wild Wild West.
I'm not walking around with Wild Wild West in my head.
No one's walking around with Wild Wild West. No one's walking around with Wild Wild West.
I watched that film a lot when I was younger.
Really? I've only seen it once. It's a bit of an enigma for me. Oh, it's famed for being kind of awful.
Yeah, but I think I watched it a lot. I watched.
Is that the one that Will Smith turned down to do play Neo as the Matrix and ended up doing Wild Wild West instead?
Oh, did he actually? Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know he was offered Neo.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, he was offered Neo.
That would be a different movie.
Would have wanted to take it, and then he's late. I don't know if he knew this at the time, but he later had a theory that they were never going to cast two black actors at that film. And he's like, if I had been cast as Neo, they wouldn't have cast Lawrence Fishburne as Morpheus.
Very sad.
So he's like, he's obviously really glad the Matrix is there and it did its thing. But also, Will Smith was totally in the right space to be cast as Neo at that moment in time in his career. But obviously,
Wild Wild West was also made by Barry Sonnenfeld, who made Men in Black.
Right. Okay.
So he was off the back of Men in Black, the success of that. Barry Sonnenfeld used to be a cinematographer, and he was the cinematographer on When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, beautiful film. Absolutely beautiful to look at. But yeah, those are the films. That's all she wrote for episode 123.
123. That's all she wrote, guys. Thanks for sticking with us. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Ripley,
see you
Civil
on
World.
Episode 456.
Yeah,
that'll be good. Cut 8 years.
No, see you guys later this week for some bonus content. We will be reviewing Scoop, Prince Andrew interview thing.
The first Omen.
The first Omen is the end one.
Yeah.
First Omen, horror film. We've had two horror films recently, Immaculate and Late Night with the Devil.
Lots of horror films coming out.
First Omen. It's like 6 months on from Halloween. It's like a 6 month Halloween thing.
Someone was like, shit, we got all these. Just put them out.
As ever, guys, email in. Thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. Like, subscribe, share, follow.
New episodes every
Shout
Wednesday.
Shout from the rooftops. Thanks for bearing with us today.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.